Good afternoon, everyone. The Health and Human Services Finance Division will come to order. And do we have a quorum yet? Okay, and while we are, the first order of business, I think, will be for me to just introduce to all of you our new committee administrator, Patrick McQuillan, who's on my left. No more musical committee administrators, for now, anyway, we hope. You never know, right? Things happen as we get further into session. People get busy, and, you know, there's a lot of running around by everyone. But really glad to have Mr. McQuillan on board, finally. And so we do have a quorum. So is there a motion to approve the minutes of the last meeting, January 17th?
So moved.
Okay, we have people fighting to make the motion. Representative Mann moves that to approve the minutes of January 17th. Is there any discussion to the minutes? I know everyone's read them thoroughly. All right. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. And the minutes are approved. Thank you. Okay. So the next order of business is to continue the very helpful, at least I'm finding it very helpful, overview from the Department of Human Services. Mr. Greenman is here. Ms. Kutsa, am I saying your name right?
It's Kutsa.
Kutsa.
Yep.
Kutsa. Okay. Thank you. And so they're going to finish their overview of the budget. And members, you had a handout last time, and you might want to look in your folder, see if you kept that handout. I think it's this one. And just remember that when you leave something on the table, it will tend to disappear. And if you want to keep it, you need to put it in your save folder in your folder, and then we'll have it there for you the next time. But we can give you another one, right, if you don't have it. So, but it looks like I'm not seeing anybody say they don't. So, okay. So, Mr. Greenman or Ms. Kutsa. Okay. Go ahead, please.
Great. Thank you so much again for having us back. I'm just to reintroduce myself. My name is Alex Kutsa. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Human Services.
Excuse me, and I'm Dave Greenman. I'm the Budget Director at the department.
So we stopped on slide 28, and this section is just a general section on the forecast, and we're talking about kind of how the major drivers of the forecast. This slide, medical, it's total medical assistance. If we remember back, medical assistance makes up the vast majority of the forecast and covers both basic care and long-term care. And this graph is just what I kind of wanted to demonstrate are the trends overall in medical assistance. So the blue or the bottom section is the federal share. The green or the next section up is the state share. Then there's a small state health care access fund and a small local share related to long-term care. So kind of what I wanted to note here is that you can see that the federal share is increasing. And if you notice, Mr. Greenman mentioned last time, I don't know if you remember, but you can see the graph kind of goes up and down. And in the odd years, it's a little lower. And in the even years, it's a little higher. That's due to the managed care payment delay that's in current law. And so it would look smoother without that. Those are artificial, moving a payment from one fiscal year to the next fiscal year.
Ms. Kutsa, could you just take a moment and explain a little bit what that payment delay is? What does it represent?
Sure, absolutely. Thank you. I'm going to actually let Mr. Greenman do that. He's more of an expert on that than I am.
excuse me, Madam Chair. The legislature in the past has basically, we make payments to managed care plans for on behalf of PMAP or people on MA in the managed care programs, and normally we would make monthly payments to the managed care plans. In the past, what the legislature has decided to do was shift payments from one biennium to the next. In other words, they would take the last payment in fiscal year, in the odd-numbered fiscal year, the May or the June payment, and delay it until July until the next July, which essentially moves that payment from one biennium to the next. And so that's a way in which the legislature has reduced spending in the past. It shifts the cost, though, from one biennium to the next. And so what it does is it artificially holds down spending in the odd-numbered year and artificially increases spending in the even-numbered year.
So thank you, Mr. Greenman. So if I could just paraphrase what you just said. So it's a way of pretending that you're spending less than you are and putting it off for the next year's budget, right?
Madam Chair, that's essentially what's happening, yeah.
Okay, thanks, just so we all understand. Okay, please continue, Ms. Getza.
Thank you. So overall, what you're seeing in this graph is the federal share and the general fund are going up, and recently the Healthcare Access Fund, which is about $400 million of medical assistance spending that is now in the Healthcare Access Fund. You see that show up on the later part of the graph. That was also in current law that changed. The next slide I'm actually going to skip, because in all these slides and all this excitement, we put two of these in here. Mr. Greenman has it in his section of the presentation. I'm going to let him present that one.
Okay. Madam Chair, the next section we're going to talk about is basic care, medical assistance, basic care, and Minnesota care. And so this next slide shows in fiscal year 18, all funds spending on the medical assistance program, as Ms. Kutz's last graph displayed, was about $12.4 billion statewide, and that was for about 1.1 million medical assistance recipients average per month. Minnesota care spending was averaged about $427 million, spending was $427 million in fiscal year 18 for an average monthly enrollment of about 83,400 Minnesota care enrollees. This is the slide Ms. Kutz talked about. And I'm actually going to skip it, too, because we go into more detail on the following slides, and so I can do a little more talking about enrollment data. So the next slide shows enrollment for elderly and disabled in the MA program. The elderly and disabled is growing at a pretty steady rate of about 1.5% per year on average. Underlying this is the elderly population is increasing at a rate of about 3% per year, while the disabled population on MA is holding steady or slightly increasing by a very small amount. In terms of MA enrollment for adults without kids, the enrollment, if you compare fiscal year 16 to fiscal year 23, enrollment is pretty flat, although it does go up and down in the intervening years. And it falls from 2016 to 2017 due to the impact of 2016 renewals, during which about 30,000 people didn't renew coverage. And some of those people were added back on over the course of the year, but typically some people fall off during that period. Growth slows for this group also in fiscal year 20 and 21 due to periodic data matching being implemented, which we're implementing right now. And the population is growing about negative 0.3%. The periodic data matching, once it's up and running in fiscal year 21, is expected to reduce enrollment by about 14,000 people average per month, or about 7%.
And Mr. Greenman, to that point, that there's an expectation that periodic data matching will reduce the enrollments, that's kind of interesting. Is that because you think there are people who are ineligible, who are on the program, that are going to be caught and fall off? Mm-hmm. Or are there other reasons why there's a projection that it's going to be that much lower? Because that is a significant expectation.
Madam Chair, the
Mr. Greenman.
The assumption around periodic data matching is that there are people who are on the program who, for one reason or another, they're either not eligible or they don't wish to continue to stay on the program, but we renew their eligibility, you know, periodically, annually, or every 6 months. And what periodic data matching does is it essentially catches that if the person is no longer eligible or if they're not wishing to stay enrolled in the program, what this does is it gets them off the program sooner than they would normally have been gotten off the program.
And but, Mr. Greenman, are there also projected to be people in there who are removed perhaps erroneously from the program? Or I mean, I'm just curious that there's an actual forecast of how many people will drop off the program when that comes online. And you know, I've never heard that before, that there was an actual forecast has been done of how many that will affect. Can you speak to that anymore?
Sure, thank you, Madam Chair. Members, as Mr. Greenman said, there is a group in this, in the original fiscal note, there's a group that would drop off because they no longer, we catch them sooner that they had a change in circumstance that would make them either no longer eligible or they don't wish to continue in the program. We also believe, and was in the forecast, that some people will not return the paperwork or not follow up enough to stay on the program. So that is also captured here. There is some people coming back then. We anticipate that there's that will be some churn, additional churn in the program.
Okay. Thank you. Please continue.
The next slide is medical assistance enrollment for families with kids. Overall, families with children are enrollments increasing by about 0.6% a year on average from fiscal year 16 to fiscal year 23. The 2016 renewals dropped by about 28,000, dropped about 28,000 people off the program in fiscal year 17. The 2016 renewals dropped about 28,000 people off. 2017 renewals dropped about 9,000 off. This just happens when people don't return the paperwork during the renewal period. And then, again, periodic data matching is expected to reduce enrollment in the program by about 14,000 in fiscal year 21, which is about a 2% reduction. The next slide shows MA expenditures.
Excuse me a second, we have a question. Representative Kunesh-Podein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When these, that was a lot of number, a lot of numbers about dropping off, and you were saying it might be because they haven't turned in the paperwork. Is that right? So when that happens, is there a grace period, or are they like just cut off? Our families cut off, and if there are children that are receiving continual medication, I'm thinking like asthma or diabetes or something like that, are they immediately cut off from those services, from pharmaceuticals, and then how long would it take them to get re-enrolled because of that lag in paperwork?
Mr. Greenman?
Madam Chair, Representative. That's a good question. I do believe that there is some grace period involved here. I don't know exactly what it is. I don't know the details of it. We can certainly find out, get the details of that for you. And then there is retroactive eligibility going back to a certain, I think it goes back up to 3 months during which a person's eligible for the program. So once they, if they become disenrolled and then re-enroll, there's retroactive eligibility.
Representative Kunesh-Podein.
Thank you. Just to follow up, but if there are medical necessities or urgencies within that retro time, let's say the 3 months, are those families getting the care? Are those children getting the medical attention and the pharmaceuticals or the, whatever it is they need to sustain themselves? Are they still getting those services?
Mr. Greenman?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure if I can answer that question in terms of whether they're getting the services or not. If they don't have coverage at the time, that probably limits their options. But I probably would want to consult with some of our staff that work on the healthcare programs and get a little more information about that for you.
And maybe, Mr. Chun, is that something that you can shed some light on right now, if you know, like, kind of what happens when somebody's dropped off the program? Is there a grace period?
Madam Chair, I don't have information right now. I'd have to check as well.
Okay. Okay. We can work on getting that information for you, Representative Kunesh-Podein. Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and hoping Mr. Greenman can kind of double-check some of my math, because I'm good at some things. I'm less impressive at others. But just trying to figure this out as far as a per-enrollee expense. If 2018, we have $12.4 billion in expenditures with an average roughly enrollment around 1.1 million. That gets me to an expense of roughly $11,250 per individual enrollee. If we take that times the 14,000 enrollees, that would be wouldn't be eligible once the periodic data matching is implemented. I come up with $157 million a year in annual savings to Medicaid, so just over $300 million in savings in a biennium. Does my math work on that? Does that check out?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Greenman.
Representative Zerwas, the average monthly cost or the average annual cost per enrollee in medical assistance varies quite a bit between whether you're a healthy family or somebody on the disability waiver program. I mean, the costs vary substantially. And the cost of care for the population that are subject to the periodic data matching, which would be adults without kids and families with kids, is significantly lower than sort of the higher group, the higher cost group. So we can certainly get you the projected savings from implementing periodic data matching. Maybe that's the way to go, is get you that information. We can certainly get that for you.
Representative Zerwas, I was going to actually, I'm glad Mr. Greenman pointed out that the average in this case covers a huge extremes, and in fact, we know under some of the waiver programs, we had an OLA report about the home and community-based services, and I did the math there myself, and the average for some of the providers was just, you know, way up, like over 100,000 for some. Now, you know, that we have some folks that have very severe needs, and so, you know, when you're doing the average, naturally, it's going to be all hidden in there. The other thing I think is important to think about when we think about savings from periodic data matching is that kind of what Representative Kunesh-Podein was talking about, if people just lose eligibility because they didn't get their paperwork in or something, those people don't disappear and their needs don't disappear. So, you know, for example, if we're talking about a child who doesn't get some need met and then that need becomes, you know, say you break your ankle, you don't get it set properly, it heals improperly, that could be a lifetime impact, disability, whatever, that could cost, if we're going to talk about dollars and cents, in a lot of other ways. So I think we have to be kind of careful when we talk about savings in this area, because it isn't just math. I mean, I was also, when I see those kind of things like you, I want to divide it out right away. There's a lot of ins and outs to this. And as you very well know, because you're often the best spokesperson of this, sometimes, too, just the bureaucracy itself can be very costly. Absolutely. I know exactly how to push your buttons, Representative Zerwas. Anyway, please, are there other questions along these lines before we continue? Okay. Mr. Berg, did you want to add something here?
Well, Madam Chair, just again, Mr. Greenman's right that actually calculating the right number, but again, to get at that 11,000, if you look at one of these two categories exclusively, the adults without children, current federal reimbursement for that category is 92% of the cost. State's only paying 8% of that. Goes to 90% and 10% next year. But so it's the average is not instructive in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. Okay, please continue.
Okay, Madam Chair, and the next slide shows MA expenditures breaks up MA expenditures between federal and state shares for basic care families with kids. Again, not to sort of beat a dead horse, but the you can see the amounts flipping back and forth, up and down between the years in which payments were shifted and when they weren't. Without the shifts, expenditures for basic care for families with kids would grow by about 4% per year on average. About a fifth of that, or 20%, is due to enrollment. The next slide shows MA expenditures.
Mr. Greenman, so we're on slide 36, right? That's the
yep.
Or the number. I guess the number is kind of messed up here, but it's page 36, I guess, right? Is that what we're looking at?
We were, yes, correct. That's correct, Madam Chair.
I think ours is page 39.
Oh, okay. I see. Okay. Okay. So page 39, and what you have on the screen is numbered differently. Okay. So I want to make sure we're all looking at the same things. Okay. All right, I had another question about that. So you said that the cost is, the enrollment is growing 20% a year?
Madam Chair, enrollment's about 20% of the share of the cost increase.
Okay, and so, Mr. Greenman, the rest of the share of the cost increase is increase in medical cost? Is that kind of the implication?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. Everyone know where we are now in the packet? Mm-hmm. Page 39. Okay, maybe I'm the only one who was on the wrong page. Okay, go ahead.
I apologize if our slides are a little out of order. The next slide shows basic care expenditures for MA adults without kids. As you can see, this gets at Mr. Berg's point earlier about the high federal share we get for this population. Since this group is virtually all funded with federal dollars up until recently, the shift between managed care...
I'm sorry. Okay. We're distracted because we're trying to find the right page. And in our packets, it's 38. So...
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right? Does everybody have that? Okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I apologize for getting everybody confused. So this shows the total spending on adults without kids over time. The green amount is the state share, and as you can see, it starts out without anything or very small. As we had a 100% federal match in calendar year 16, and that's going to go down to about 90% federal match in calendar year 2020 and beyond. Average growth for this population is about 5%.
So this goes back to what Mr. Berg was talking about, that if we, the savings to us in our state budget, if we say we just said, let's get rid of these, we're not going to give health care to these people anymore, we're saving some state money, but mainly federal money. Please continue.
The next slide is the basic care expenditures for elderly and disabled, and the basic story here is that the average growth is expected to be about 6% per year on average for this population.
And we're on page 37 in our packets, members.
And finally, the next slide shows basic care forecast trends, all funds for the MA program. Elderly and disabled.
Mr. Greenman, when you say the next slide, you got to give us a moment because we don't know what the next slide is.
Oh, sorry.
Page 40. Okay.
They're in a different order.
Because otherwise, it's hard to. I want to listen to what you say, and it's hard when we're shuffling paper. So, page 40 in our packets. Okay. Please go ahead.
So what this shows is all fund spending on basic care for adults without kids, families with children, and elderly and disabled. The elderly and disabled growth in spending is attributable about 25% to enrollment and about 75% to the cost of care. Families with kids and adults with kids grow from fiscal year 14 to 21 is mainly the result of enrollment growth in these programs. You'll note that fiscal year 15 is the first full year under the ACA, and you can see the impact of enrollment growth as people shifted from the Minnesota Care Program to the MA program for adults without kids. Another issue here is the $270 million shift. You're also seeing the spending shift from one year to the next, the payment delays, which results in about a $540 million movement from one year to the next in spending. Note that the impact of the shift in 2015 is masked by the influx of ACA-induced enrollment during that year. And then spending in 2017 is relatively low, partially due to the first full year of reduced managed care rates resulting from the 2016 competitive bidding process. And then overall spending on medical assistance basic care from 2019 to 2023 is projected to grow by about 6% per year. About 2% is due to enrollment, and about 4% is due to the cost of care. Okay.
And we have a question, Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question on the federal funding versus state. You said that the one fund for adults without children dropped to 90%. Are we going to see further drops in that as we go forward? And also, what's the basis for the difference between federal funds being so high for adults without children and looking lower for families with children?
Mr. Greenman.
Madam Chair, Representative, my understanding is that the federal share for adults without kids is set in federal law, and it is not going to go below. It's not, and currently in federal law, it's not supposed to go below 90%. So that's where it drops off to. It started at 100%, and it was phased down in federal law to 90%. The match that states receive generally on medical assistance is based on population and poverty rates. And so each state receives a certain federal share for the medical assistance program that's sort of its basic matching rate. And the basic matching rate in Minnesota is 50%, which is, I believe that's the federal minimum rate. And so for the most part, from most parts of medical assistance, we receive a 50% matching rate. There are some specific services and populations for which we receive a higher match than that, and those are set in federal law. But for the most part, our matching rate is 50%. But for certain populations, we do receive, or for certain services, we'll receive an additional enhanced rate.
Thank you. Representative Bierman, did that
help?
So I think that before I call on Representative Loeffler, I think that part of this and what Mr. Greenman is talking about is kind of the difference between what happened with the Affordable Care Act, mm-hmm. because it used to be that in order to be eligible for medical assistance, you had to, in addition to being poor, you had to fit certain categories. So if you were an adult without children, you just weren't eligible, no matter how poor you were. You weren't going on MA. Okay. And the ACA said, you know, you've maybe heard the term expansion population. Mm-hmm. These are people who meet the financial eligibility but previously would have been just excluded because they weren't, you know, they were adults without children. So that population was under the ACA was where the federal government said we're going to pay for it initially and then pay a little less of it as time goes on. But the people that were already eligible, we were always getting this 50-50 match. So does that make it a little bit clearer?
Yes.
I mean, it's, you know, so never a simple thing around here. Mr. Berg, did you want to add something to that? Okay. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to also say that this slide also shows the risks that we have. I mean, we've talked about how the federal law changes influence our budget. there's now a discussion in Washington of block granting MA. And when we have projections that say we're going to have 2% growth in enrollment just because we have more seniors who outlive their savings or more people with disabilities because of modern medicine and saving some people but not quite at 100%, that's at risk as well as the medical inflation. And so while it was really nice to get those 90% reimbursements, there's discussion now that could shake that up as well.
All right, please continue.
I'm sorry. I do have a couple more questions. Representative Kunesh-Podein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering, and maybe this isn't the right, at this point is the right time to ask this, but how is the shutdown affecting our medical assistance program at this time? And if there's reserves or if there's backup funding, that's going to be available. If this were to continue another month, say another 2 months, what would happen to these programs that are so heavily funded from the federal government?
Yeah, and Representative Kunesh-Podein, that does kind of pull us way off in a direction. Okay. I don't know if Mr. Greenman is. Okay. I think the short answer might be it's not really affecting it right now. Is there a 20-second answer you can give?
Madam Chair, I think you're correct. It's not really affecting it right now. I think if the shutdown were to go on longer, we'd have to probably reassess where we're at. But I'm not sure if Ms. Kutza has anything more to add.
And Representative Kunesh-Podein, I don't mean to shut down the question because I think it's extremely valid and important. But you know what? Let's hope we don't have to have a hearing on that. Because if it begins to affect us, then I think we probably will need to schedule a hearing on that very topic.
Okay,
yeah, thanks for bringing that up. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And there's a lot to deal with here, so I feel like we're bouncing all over, so I apologize if I'm taking us in another direction. But I did want to just lift up and see if there's any further comments regarding a statement that was made that enrollment is increasing by 2%, but the cost is increasing by 4%. So are you attributing that to, and I'm sorry I'm talking to you through the chair, so literally through the chair and figuratively. Is that attributable to the cost of services, inpatient, outpatient, the cost of drugs? Is that 4%? So we're basically seeing double the increase in just in cost, not in terms of utilization. Can you comment any more on that?
Representative Halverson, we do assume when we trend out projected expenditures for medical assistance spending, we do project growth in whether you want to call it inflation or increasing costs of care, about 4 to 5% increase from year to year in spending per enrollee.
Madam Chair.
Representative Halverson.
And would you say that's about twice the rate of inflation for other goods and services? That seems to be about the math that I've been coming up with.
Mr. Greenman.
Madam Chair, I don't know the inflation rate.
Well, Madam Chair,
Representative Halverson.
I think I heard that recently on the radio. That's typically been the trend recently with regard to cost. I don't think we can lose sight of the fact that we're looking at the state really does provide a lot of support for healthcare, and the fact that healthcare costs so much has a real big impact on our state budget. And so, as you know, that's my favorite topic. And so I want to be sure that we are thinking about cost along with all this enrollment discussion. So thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Representative Halverson. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, my question is probably kind of along the same line there. You know, some states didn't accept the expansion of federal money to expand medical assistance because they were concerned about the federal government reducing their subsidy and also the growth of their Medicaid program in terms of their state budget. But there's been, you know, federal studies, and we've had our own state demographers say that if we don't reform or get, you know, government health care under control, the growth of it, Tom Gillespie, the former state, he said there would be no additional money for K-12, higher ed, or roads or bridges. Well, I don't think any of us want that. and maybe this isn't the time to discuss it, but I'm just wondering what, you know, other states are doing in terms of reforms to meet the needs of their citizens and yet do it in a way that actually brings down the growth of the Medicaid program. So, you know, it's something maybe to discuss further, but are other states trying to deal with this growth? Because I know, you know, the studies show we're going to bankrupt the state in the long run. And, of course, we're talking about growth rates here that are faster than the growth of private sector, faster than the growth of personal income. And that's a formula for, you know, fiscal disaster down the road, especially with the demographic changes. But as far as you're aware, Director Greenman, are you aware of other states trying to reform this in a way that meets the needs of their citizens but yet slows the growth?
And if I could just jump in for a second, Representative Gruenhagen, I think it's an excellent question, one that we really should examine. But when you preface it by saying maybe now isn't the time to discuss this, probably means it isn't. And
I've given you a chance.
Yeah, right. Thank you for that. Just in the interest of time, I think this is a tremendously important discussion. And could we put a pin in that one? And maybe Mr. McQuillan can make a note, because I really think it is it will be important to talk about that. And I know that Representative Schultz wanted to say something. I don't want to pull us too off
sure.
base here. But one thing I did want to I'm going to let you follow up and then
well, just ahead. Madam Chair, just a quick comment in agreement with you. I kind of raised the issue that maybe in the future we could have some information on this. And well, I think federally we have $100 trillion of unfunded liabilities. Now that includes Social Security, Medicare, everything else. But Medicaid is a big part of it. And I think we need to look at, you know, we got 50 different laboratories out there, states. And it'd be interesting to see what other states are doing in order to address this and still meet the needs of their citizens. And, you know, I don't like the word cut people off the benefits if they really need it. I prefer the word reform the system in a way that meets their needs but keeps the growth fiscally under control. Thank you, Madam.
Well, thank you, Representative Gruenhagen. I think we're going to have a lot of common cause around this because – I think that but the question might be how do we address this? And I just would like to ask Mr. Greenman, maybe Representative Schultz was going to get at this, but I know like a component of this growth is changes that the legislature makes. And, of course, since even these programs that are forecast programs, or you might want to call them entitlement programs, we set the rules for how the payments are made in various areas and so on. And could you just discuss for a moment, if you know, where the changes around nursing home payments fit into this? Are we seeing a growth pattern? Is there a projected growth pattern around that because of the way that the legislature changed payments to nursing homes?
Madam Chair, we can certainly talk about that now. Ms. Kutza was going to talk about it when her chief's going to talk about long-term care spending, and so she was going to cover it at that
okay.
point.
Thank you. We will put a pin in that one. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to clarify that when we talk about medical cost and medical cost inflation, there's prices of medical care, and then there's intensity or utilization of medical care to get the total spend. So here we're talking about growth in enrollment, which would increase utilization, and then price increases. And to Representative Gruenhagen's point, we really do need to focus on the cost growth, and that's both – mostly it's been responsible because the prices are going up. So really looking at prices. But I think we're going to have an opportunity when we start hearing bills about changing how we pay providers to give them the right incentive to minimize costs and maximize population health. So I'm glad that you're concerned about this. And, you know, this state has been really at the forefront, Minnesota has, in trying to change the way we pay. So we had the PMAP program, and then we have this competitive bidding process. And we're not really realizing the cost savings we should be. So I think we need to really focus on how we can change those incentives to get the outcomes we desire.
Thank you. Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When we do come back to this particular topic, would it be possible for everyone to have the study that Representative Gruenhagen is talking about so we're all on the same page?
Thank you. Representative Mann, I'm not sure if he was talking about Representative Gruenhagen. Were you talking about a particular study that you wanted
Tom
to bring forward?
He's retired now. He's a state demographer. I believe it's 2010 because the same year I first ran for
election. He came out with a study that basically said if you don't get government health care under control, the growth of it in the state of Minnesota, there will be no additional money for K-12, higher ed, or roads or bridges. So we definitely need to take that into consideration in meeting the needs of our citizens and yet understanding reforms that might, like Representative Schultz said, bring more accountability and maybe some reforms in how we meet those needs. And but yeah, Tom Gillespie was the state monitor. We have a different one now, but I'm sure they can fund that study.
Yeah, thank you. And maybe Mr. McQuillan will make a note on that, and we'll. But I think the point that I'm taking from you, Representative Grunhagen, is just that we need to pay attention to the growth of cost in our HHS budget, which is always, always an issue. And I think that we are going to do some work this session. We're going to try to address kind of what Representative Schultz was talking about, you know, to see if we can bend the cost curve a little bit. As long as we understand that when we are talking about forecasted programs, that you can't capture the money you save. It doesn't go into a fund that you can then spend on something else. And we got to make sure, at least from my point of view, you know, it falls to the bottom line. It shows up as a quote-unquote surplus, and that we understand that we're going to have, that we still have growing costs even if we're able to reduce the growth. So anyway, I'll go back to our testifiers, and maybe we can get through maybe we can get through some more of the presentation.
So the next slide shows you Minnesota Care enrollment numbers. It splits them between the higher end, which is the higher top half, which is the families with kids, and the lower half, which is adults without children. I would add virtually all the people on Minnesota Care are adults because kids are eligible for MA beyond the Minnesota Care income limit. The enrollment drop from 2016 to 2017 is due to the impact of 2016 renewals and also stricter enforcement of non-payment of premiums between 2016 and 2017. Annual average growth for the Minnesota Care enrollment is about 1.7% between fiscal year 17 and fiscal year 23. And in this case, periodic data matching does impact this program as well, and we expect a loss of about 2,600 enrollees in fiscal year 21 for this program. The next slot.
Excuse me, Representative Spoonish Padin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What is non-payment premium? Who is not paying that premium?
Mr. Greenman.
Madam Chair, Representative, the Minnesota Care program requires enrollees to pay a premium, a monthly premium, as a condition of being part of the program. Mm-hmm. And people have to, and the premium is set based on income. Mm-hmm. And so as part of the program, one of the responsibilities of the enrollee is to make that payment. And I think there is a grace period if they don't make the payment right away. But after a certain period of time, people are disenrolled when they don't make the premium payments.
Representative Kunesh-Padin.
Does that preclude them from re-enrolling perhaps later on? Is it like one and done? You didn't do it, now you're done, you're off? Or are you able to go back and rectify whatever the situation was and get re-enrolled eventually?
Mr. Greenman.
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe there's some kind of a way to get back on the program, but I think that's something our healthcare eligibility people would probably be able to better answer than I, and we can go back and get the answer to that.
Okay. Please go ahead.
So the next slide in this section deals with Minnesota Care forecast trends on spending. You can see the slide runs from fiscal year 2010 to 2023. The large reduction in enrollment between fiscal year 11 and 12 is due to shifting about 50,000 adults without kids from Minnesota Care to the MA program under the Medicaid expansion and the ACA. The let's see, in 2000, some other things to sort of highlight here. In 2015, the federal revenue changed from coming under a medical assistance waiver, in other words, where we received a federal match for the Minnesota care population, and switched to the basic health plan, under which we received, I believe, 95% of the premium subsidies and tax credits that the person enrolled in the program would have received had they purchased coverage in the private sector. The state only, the health care access fund portion of the state share starting in fiscal year 17 is basically older senior citizens who are not eligible for the basic health plan. So they're enrolled in Minnesota Care just like everybody else, but they're not eligible for the basic health plan because they don't have enough, or they're not eligible for Medicare, and they're not enrolled in the basic health plan, but they're on Minnesota Care. So essentially they're on Minnesota Care. They just don't get basic health plan funding, and they're paid for through the health care access fund. This is a population that doesn't have enough work credits to qualify for Medicare, and that's why they're on Minnesota Care instead of Medicare. Spending in 2017 is relatively low. This is partly due to the first full year of reduced managed care rates resulting from 2016 contract negotiations and competitive bidding, and then also lower enrollments due to cleaning up of renewals and better enforcement of non-payment of premiums in the last half of 2016. Better enforcement of premiums resulted in an increase in average premium payments from $29 per month to $39 per month in fiscal year 17. The other thing to note is in 2017, you see a jump in the federal share, and that's due to an increase in the second lowest cost silver plan, which jumped 60%, and that resulted in a big increase in federal funds because we received money based on what people would have paid in the private sector for their coverage. From fiscal year 19 to fiscal year 23, our expenditures are projected to increase about 8.5% per year overall. It's about 40% due to enrollment, about 60% due to the cost of care. That's all I'll say about that one.
Okay, and the next section on long-term care, which I'm very interested in, but I just want to kind of give you the timing here because we do have another presentation after this one. So what about 42? So we only have about 12 minutes. If members, if we could kind of hold our questions until we get to the end, then hopefully we'll have a chance to ask some questions too. Ms. Grazia?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try and go quickly. This section is about the long-term care and the waivers and the forecast. The first slide here is looking at the expenditures, and the bottom section by fund, this is federal, state, and there's a small county share. Long-term care facilities and waivers serve mostly elderly and disabled. The payments are about 75% of the payments we make are for waivers and home and community-based services, so not in a residential or long-term care facility. Long-term care has grown at an annualized rate of about 5%, and it increases to about 7% in the forecast years. As Madam Chair mentioned earlier, the long-term care facilities payment growth is driven by some legislative changes that were made in 2016 called value-based reimbursement for nursing facilities, and that has mainly driven the increases in cost, which are about 6% per year in the long-term care facilities. There is no recipient growth. Actually, the recipients are decreasing slightly in our long-term care facilities area. On the waiver and home and community-based services side, the payment growth is about 8% annually, and about 5.5% of that is due to the recipients increasing, and that's because we took some, by law, the caps came off of our CADI. I'm going to tell you what that stands for. Just, I keep forgetting because we changed it. Community Access for Disability Inclusion waiver, and for our personal care assistance. So that's what's driving the enrollment growth. On the on the recipients, as I mentioned before, what you can see here is there's a slight decrease in the recipient growth for the long-term care facilities, and then the increase is all coming in the waivers and the home and community-based services. Again, this is because caps came off of waivers. More people are eligible for personal care assistance services and also the elderly waiver. I think I covered most of that in the previous slide. In the interest of time, I'll go on to the next one. I wanted to spend a few minutes looking at the trends. So this is, again, going from 2010 all the way to 23, and what you see here is almost all of the growth in the top green section is in the area of waivers and home and community-based services. We're really not seeing, except for the growth in cost on the facility side, which is driven, again, by some legislative changes and the value-based reimbursement, we're not seeing growth in that area from recipients. For the home and community-based services area, about 38% of the spending in this area is in the disability developmental disabilities waiver. 29% is in the community alternative for disability inclusion. I'm going to go into this a little more in the next slide. CAC, which is community alternative care and brain injury waivers. And then 21% is in personal care and home care nursing. And about 12% is elderly waivers. So that green, what I'm trying to say, and it really complicated with lots of percentages, is there are lots of pieces that make up the long-term care waivers and home and community-based services, and you are eligible for those based on different criteria. What this slide is trying to show is just that our growth is really in those programs that we run. Which I then break down in this slide, you can see, and if you don't have a color copy, I apologize. Hopefully you can have access to the PDF, but there, you know, the bottom section is the disability, the developmental disability waiver. This, I know Representative Zerwas had asked earlier about the cost per person and how an average is really hard to take or really hard to use in this scenario. So I have a little bit of information on that. Overall, disability services waivers served about 45,000 individuals each month in fiscal year 18, and the average monthly cost was about $4,500 per month. The disability waiver payments from 2018 to 23 are growing, projected at about 8%, with about 4.5% of that attributable to growth in recipients in the number of people who are being served, and about 3.5% to average payment. But specifically in the DD waiver, what we call the DD waiver, the developmental disability waiver, in 2018 there is unduplicated annual recipients of 20,150, and the average cost of that was about $69,000 or $1.4 billion for that year. So these are some folks that are more expensive than a child on, say, one of our MA programs. I am happy to go through. I have average costs and the number of recipients for each of those. Madam Chair, I can go through those, or I could send them to you in an email if that would be more useful.
I think that would be great, and we could provide those to the committee because I think that would be really instructive.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. Basically, what this slide is doing, except for this does not include elderly waiver or the personal care assistance home health, this is breaking down the four waivers, the DD, CADI, CAC, and BI, into their components, and I'll send you the what's driving that increase in the average costs and enrollees for fiscal year 18. Okay. Elderly waiver, that was not included in the last one. This served about 25,200 individuals each month in fiscal year 18 at an average monthly cost of about $1,439. It's growing at about 7%, and 4.1% of that is recipient growth, and about 2.8% is average payment. We're thinking this is going to keep growing at this level because the elderly population is increasing in the state and across the nation.
Madam Chair, will they include those statistics in the information?
Representative Grunhagen.
Will they include those the growth projections in the information?
Ms. Cuzzio, will you include the growth projections when you send us that The breakdown, I agree. It's very helpful to hear that, you know, where the growth is occurring.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'd be happy to. We'll make sure we include
Thank you.
That.
Thanks, Representative Grunhagen. Please continue.
I wanted to note, if you look at the, as we've kind of hammered home here, the odd numbered years, you're seeing that decrease, the artificial decrease because of the managed care. This program is impacted by that also. So that's what you're seeing in those odd number years, the managed care payment delay. So those were all the waivers, and I'll send you all of that information on that. Now on the long-term care facility forecast trend, this is looking at both nursing facilities and intermediate care facilities, and you can see that the average monthly caseload in nursing facilities has been declining for over 20 years due to our shift to community-based care and how we've shifted how we care for folks more in the community. Again, the average payment increases in the forecast years settle in around 7% here. The average monthly caseload is about 14,300. And all of that is actually due to average payment. Again, we're seeing some declines in the number of people taking up services recipients in these areas. On the intermediate care facilities, they're a much smaller portion of this. They're only that small upper piece of the graph. And they serve about an average monthly caseload of 1,370 people. They are actually from 18 to 23, the annual costs are projected to decrease by an average of 3% per year, driven by recipient decreases. We're seeing less people in these programs. I can answer any questions. I know I went through that quickly. I wanted to go back to something I had said earlier. We presented at the last meeting. This area of the forecast is the main cost driver of MA in the forecast. It serves less people than the other programs, but as Mr. Greenman pointed out, we get a large federal share for adults without children, and typically the cost for families and children and adults without children is lower. Per individual cost in these programs is much higher, so it's the main driver and spends about two-thirds of our entire MA budget. So I think it's really important to understand how that breaks down and how we serve people with disabilities and elderly on these programs.
Okay. Well, thank you for that, Ms. Kotzian. I have a question. We have talked a lot in the past about eligibility and whether people are getting on these programs who don't, in fact, meet eligibility. When we talk about things like periodic data match, are we talking about the disabled population, the people that you just said are the big cross driver? Or are we just talking about the women and children and adults without children and stuff like that, the low-cost people?
Madam Chair, the periodic data matching impacts household, mainly in impacts families with kids and adults without children, that population group. It doesn't impact elderly and disabled.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Other questions, members? Ms. Kutzia and Mr. Greenman, do you have more that you need to cover here? We'll just have a couple minutes. I see we have some slides that we didn't talk about, but were you going to go through those, or is that
I can really briefly describe them to you so you can just follow along. The next slide that talks about MFIP-TY child care and North Star forecast trends. These are forecasted programs that aren't in the MA program. These are more or less economic assistance programs. This shows the cash portion of the Minnesota Family Investment Program, which is our main economic assistance program for families with kids. It also shows that's at the bottom. The middle bar is our child care this child care services for that population, the services they receive, and then the last bar at the top is our North Star Care, and that provides a monthly cash assistance or monthly assistance to families with children who are in either the kinship care program, adoption assistance, or in foster care. And those are all forecasted programs. The next slide, thanks, shows total MFIP spending. The distinction here between this slide showing MFIP spending and the previous slide is The previous slide just showed the cash portion. This shows the cash portion plus the food portion. So this shows total spending. This includes the SNAP portion of the MFIT program, as well as other expenditures. The last slide is our Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund. This is another forecasted program. This is a mix of state, federal, and county sources of financing and provides assistance to people who fall within income limits, and it includes both residential and non-residential substance use disorder treatment services. And that's...
Okay. Thank you very much for your presentation. Do we have questions? Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would you have any information on how much money we're spending on kinship care versus foster care?
Madam Chair, Representative Moran, we can certainly get that for you. I think we've got it pretty, we can get it for you pretty quickly.
And Madam Chair.
Representative Moran, are you speaking into the mic? I'm sorry, can you I can't also, hear you too well.
Can you also give me the information you're going to get Mary? Because she took every one of my questions. I'm sorry, Representative Kunis-Fordeen. If you can also share that information with me, that would be great.
Okay, thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you. We spent a lot of time talking about chemical dependency and opioids and all those sorts of things, and I see a pretty steep projected growth in those, and if we could get that broken down by federal, state, and county as well, that would be great.
Okay, thank you. I see Mr. Greenman's nodding. Okay. Other questions? Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Also, could you send us the number of children that are enrolled in Minnesota Care?
Children on Minnesota Care? Okay. Very good. All right. Very good. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. We're going to have an overview of the Minnesota Healthcare Licensing Boards. And we, in the interest of time, we didn't invite every one of them because there are quite a few. I'm not exactly sure how many. But we asked the executive directors of the two of the largest, I think. I know the Board of Nursing is one of the largest. And so we're going to ask you, welcome to the committee, Ms. Brecken and Ms. Martinez, and we're going to ask you to give us kind of a quick overview of what the boards do. And as this is a budget committee and we're going to be looking at not only your budgets but the budgets of other health licensing boards, if you can kind of, are we having technical difficulties?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. I'm Ruth Martinez. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice. And
good afternoon, Madam Chair and representatives. I'm Shirley Brecken. I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Nursing. I'd also like to point out that there are several of the other executive directors from the other health-related licensing boards. Maybe they could wave their hands and you'd see who they are.
Okay, thank you.
That are here this afternoon also.
That's great. And if we have questions, maybe they'll be able to step in and answer them if they're specific to their boards. Anyway, please, are we waiting to try to get slides up?
Madam Chair, members, you do have a handout of the PowerPoint that we're going to be following. So if it doesn't come up, we can.
All right. Well,
okay.
Go ahead and proceed in the interest of time.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll go ahead and begin, and we'll be giving you, as we've mentioned, an overview today of the health licensing boards, and there are 16 health licensing boards. In answer to that question about how many of us there are, we are very happy to be here today, and we'll give you a kind of a high-level overview, and, of course, we welcome your questions as we move through the slides today through the PowerPoint. Do we know if this is?
It's not up yet.
Okay. We're just going to forge ahead because I know time is of the essence here.
I hope the members found that this is the sheet, I take
yes,
it.
Yes, that is yeah. it. Okay. Thank you.
Great.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the health licensing boards are part of the executive branch of government. We do, however, interface with the other two branches, legislative and judicial, and we'll cover a little bit of those interactions as we move through. Like all of government, our mission is focused on the well-being of Minnesota's citizens. We are driven to protect the public. And so that's really the focus of all of the regulatory efforts that we pursue. We champion public safety, and we do that by regulating a number of healthcare professionals, hundreds of thousands of healthcare professionals across the state of Minnesota. So we'll tell you a little bit about how we accomplish that. I think I'll turn it over to Shirley at this point.
I think if, just if you're following along, I'm moved to slide three. There, as Ruth said, there are 16 health-related licensing boards, and each of us, each of the boards have an individual practice act that governs the practice of the individuals that we regulate. However, again, one of the things that I'm always very try to be very clear, even though it sounds very confusing, is we're really we are a board and we're an agency. The board actually refers to the individuals that the governor appoints to serve as the governing board of the agency. And so often when people say the board, we have to distinguish between are we talking about the individuals on the board or are we talking about the agency within state government. We are all co-located and we work together as much as we can for effectiveness and efficiency. We range in size. In terms of the number of individuals that we regulate, some as few as a few hundred and others, as with the Board of Nursing, a little over 150,000. We are subject to many of the, actually a lot of the state laws and rules and regulations that apply to other agencies, like such as DHS that you just were aware of. We relate to each other as much as we are able so that we can experience those efficiencies that are important.
And in that spirit, I just wanted to talk a little bit about the collaboration among the boards. We are each individual agencies, as Shirley Brecken has noted, but we also do an awful lot of collaboration. And so we have formed an administrative services unit, which functions to provide common services to the boards, budget preparation, human resources, payroll processing, and so forth. We also have developed an executive directors forum. We meet on a monthly basis, coming together to talk about common interests and initiatives that we are collaboratively engaged in. And so we have bylaws and we have committees within our executive directors forum. We have a policy committee which carries forward legislation on behalf of the boards, an IT governance committee that looks at common IT issues, and a management committee that looks at our operations.
And well, as I said earlier, that each of the boards operate under individual practice acts, we do share a common piece of statute that governs how we deal with investigations and with disciplinary functions. That's Chapter 214. And Chapter 214 was actually collaboratively written and promoted legislatively by the boards and authorizes the boards to, as I said, collaborate on investigations and share investigative data within those. If we have, it's not unusual, for instance, for the Board of Nursing and the Board of Medical Practice to have, say, a common complaint, and we work together when that happens to, again, realize efficiencies and not be duplicative. Chapter 214 also establishes the Health Professional Services Program. The Health Professional Services Program is really, it's meant for public protection, but it also provides support to individuals who may have their practice impaired due to an illness. Program participants are monitored regularly. Appropriate to their illness, for example, if the individual has a substance use disorder, they may be monitored by periodic and regular drug screens. All of the boards participate in the Health Professional Services Program, and that program is funded by the boards on a pro rata share. That is, those boards that have the greatest number of participants in the program pay the greatest share of the cost to operate the program.
And I should mention also in Chapter 214,
Ms. Martinez,
yes.
I just want to remind you both we need to go through the chair because we are doing this taping thing. So I can say your names, but, you know, we need to let people who aren't watching us know who's speaking. So
thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that reminder. I just wanted to mention that under Chapter 214, we also have a criminal background check section, and all of the boards as of January 1st of 2018 have now implemented criminal background checks for all new applicants, and that's another layer of certainty that an assurance that our licensees have met the minimum requirements to serve the public.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Breckham.
The boards are also subject to many other statutes and rules, such as the Administrative Procedures Act and the Data Practices Act. In fact, those are two that we are regularly, adhering to in the hearing processes as well as the discipline process. Also of note is the Criminal Rehabilitation Act, which prohibits a board from denying a license based solely on criminal conviction. Sexual misconduct is actually an exception for some of the boards with determining that eligibility for licensure.
Madam Chair?
Ms. Martinez.
Thank you. And we also, as part of the executive branch of state government, the boards have quasi-judicial authority. We issue subpoenas. We take actions against licensees. And we work under the legal counsel of the Attorney General's office. And decisions of the health licensing boards are appealable in district court. So I just wanted to point that out because licensees also have due process rights under our practice acts. We share a philosophy that scope of practice issues should be addressed in the professional practice environment and not established by the boards. We are not lobbying organizations, but we are available to assure that legislation that might be coming forward is enforceable, is administratable under our regulatory authority. But we really do rely on the professional associations to address scope of practice issues and to advocate on behalf of the professions themselves. And I just wanted to mention one other collaborative initiative of ours. We have distinct roles, but we sometimes do come together, even with professional associations, to bring things forward. And I just wanted to mention a few of those things, like the prescription monitoring program, the interstate medical licensure compact, the APRN compact that might be coming forward soon, and also just new professions as they are emerging, such as genetic counselors. The concept of collaboration is pretty strong among the boards, as you know, as you've recognized, and we have a common statutory framework, as Ms. Brecken has pointed out. We mentioned the Administrative Services Unit, the Executive Directors Forum. We also, at our monthly meetings, have presentations by such groups as the Internal Controls Division of Government. Central IT Services often presents to us. Our committees track legislation and initiatives that are common among all of the boards.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Brecken.
Thank you. As we said earlier, the boards carry out their mission of public protection, and we do so through several functions, such as licensure, discipline, and education. Additionally, a few of the boards have the statutory authority to carry out inspections, such as the Board of Pharmacy and the Board of Dentistry. The boards hold individuals accountable for conduct based on legal, ethical, and professional standards. They achieve this mandate of public protection by promoting these standards and issuing credentials to those individuals to practice. Once a license is issued, the boards monitor the individual's compliance with state laws and take action against licenses of the healthcare professionals who exhibit unsafe practice and who present a risk of harm to the public.
I'm sorry, we have a question.
Yes,
Representative Hatton.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to either of the testifiers, do pharmacy benefits managers need to have a license to practice medicine in the state of Minnesota?
Ms. Brecken or
Madam Chair, Representative Halpton, I am not familiar with that. I do know that pharmacies regulate wholesale. They regulate pharmacies in addition to pharmacists. I am not familiar with the benefit, you know, the pharmacy benefits programs, but we can find that out for you. There is no one here from the Board of Pharmacy that I see. Oh, I see a hand raised back there, Madam Chair.
Well, I don't think he's from the Board of Pharmacy.
Okay, thank you.
I think, you know, we're kind of pulling this off track here. Representative Hamilton, I think the answer is no, but I think you've got a lot of people's attention, and we will be returning to this question. Representative Hamilton.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I was hoping you would allow us to eventually return to the question because, one, I believe they are practicing medicine without a license, and they're not any good at it, and they are harming many, many people, Madam Chair. So I would like to have this discussion further.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Hamilton. I think a lot of us are going to want to have that discussion. So I think we'll be having it. I'm sorry.
Madam
Chair. Is
there
any other questions before we? Okay. Please continue.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Brecken.
Most of the board's resources are actually directed toward compliance and complaint investigations. We operate under a complaint-driven process. That is the number, the board gets a complaint and then carries out an investigation regarding that complaint and those allegations. Sometimes I think what's really important is to recognize that, again, the due process that individuals are entitled to in that process. So even though there is a complaint that's lodged against a particular individual, there is a process and governance that the boards go through to investigate as well as come to a complete disposition of that matter. Some boards may process as few as 10 complaints a year. Other boards may process as many as close to 2,000 a year, just dependent upon the size and the number of individuals that the boards regulate. Throughout the complaint process, the boards might negotiate a settlement with the individual, or the boards may actually go to what's known as a contested case hearing, and that is much like a trial, per se, before an administrative law judge, but it is in accordance, again, with the Administrative Procedures Act. The education function that boards carry out may vary from board to board. There are those boards that actually approve continuing education programs for their particular licensees. Others, like the Board of Nursing, actually approve education programs in the state, licensure preparing programs in the state. And others may just address, all the boards address the educational requirements that are needed for someone to meet the qualifications for licensure. One of the comments that I'd like to make is the title Health-Related Licensing Boards. It does somewhat give the impression that all the boards do is license individuals, and actually the boards are very often involved in policy, providing information to you, the legislators, regarding particular healthcare policies. And we, have every once in a while considered seeking just a change to the name because of the fact that it doesn't give the whole picture of what the boards do, and would welcome a conversation about that someday. Another particular service that the boards has that has really grown, and I think all of us can appreciate that it's grown, exponentially across all of state government, and that is data services. The boards are very frequently requested to provide information about, for instance, the number of licensees, and looking at things such as workforce and some of us push data daily out to the public and to actually employers. For example, the Board of Nursing on a daily basis pushes out information on about 35,000 licensees to facilities to let, addressing the currency of the license or whether any discipline has been taken. Additionally, all of the boards publish their disciplinary data on the board's website, so the public and employers can go to our websites and know an individual's authority to practice, whether it is limited or conditioned in any way, or whether it's actually been removed.
Ms. Martinez.
Madam Chair, thank you. I wanted to touch on board operations a little bit. That's a big part of what your committee looks at, I know, and with budgets coming this session, I know you'll be seeing our budgets as soon as they come through. The board submit their biennial budgets through the governor's office, and at times that budget comes through as part of the governor's budget. At other times, we are invited to independently come forward to advocate for our budget proposal. So I just wanted to mention that. But typically, our budgets and our legislative initiatives do pass through the Health and Human Services Policy and Finance Committees. May also appear before the Judiciary Committee, Government Operations, Civil Law and Debt Practices, and Public Safety Committees. So those are usually the committees that do tend to see some of our bills as they come forward. We may be asked to appear individually or collectively. We try as much as possible in the interest of your time to come together, as you often see us traveling as a group. And so we appreciate that opportunity to visit with you about our joint initiatives. But we also have individual bills that will be coming forward. We really are looking at legislation, monitoring what's coming forward, not as lobbying organizations, but really, again, to look at how that new law coming in might be administered and enforced under our regulatory authority. So that really is our goal in monitoring and tracking various legislative initiatives. Our budget appropriation requests, as I mentioned, will be coming forward soon, and you will very likely be seeing us in front of your committee to give you a little bit more information and answer any questions you might have about our budget proposals.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Brecken.
Well, one thing that's really important to recognize is that the boards are funded by licensure fees. The boards get no general fund dollars. And their Minnesota law, actually in Chapter 214, requires the boards to collect revenue sufficient to cover expenses. But every once in a while, the boards do come forward requesting either probably a fee increase as costs have increased over the years. The funds are actually deposited in a special revenue fund, and the boards keep track of how much each of the boards put into that fund, even though it is into one fund. Then the board actually receives an appropriation from the legislature to expend those dollars from that special government revenue fund. The board also pays statewide indirect costs through an open appropriation, and the board also pays for some other programs, such as we've talked about, the Health Professional Services Program, the Infection Control Program that is administered by the Department of Health, the Prescription Monitoring Program, which is administered by the Pharmacy Board. The board also pays for all of its legal services to the Attorney General's Office, and so the appropriation is actually made to the Attorney General's Office, but it must come from our special revenue fund. The criminal background check program that is administered by all of the boards is funded by our licensure fees. And there's also a voluntary healthcare provider program, which individuals might be volunteering for clinics in a particular area of the state, such as a dental clinic, to provide services to individuals who are unable to pay for those kinds of services, and the boards fund some of the boards fund the insurance program for that particular program. You will see us again during the 2019 legislative session. We do have some legislation that we're bringing forward. Those are related to, again, to Chapter 214, which applies to all of the health-related licensing boards. As often is the case, when a particular piece of legislation is implemented, we learn we wish we had done something different. As it becomes operational, there's particular glitches along the way. And so last year, the boards came to the legislature seeking some changes regarding the authority under temporary suspensions and under some modifications to the criminal background check program. Those bills did advance through the legislative session, but were caught up in the omnibus bill, and so we anticipate that we are bringing those pieces of legislation forward again, and we've been working with the original authors of those bills regarding the changes. I know that there will be individual boards that will be bringing some legislation forward, some related to fees, as well as some things related to other pieces of work that they do. I know Madam Chair? Medical Board has something.
Okay, Ms. Martinez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do want to mention that we had a few individual bills caught up in the session last year, and I just want to thank all the representatives here who worked with us last session on a lot of the bills. You were very helpful, and we felt very strongly supported by the legislature with our bills last year, and it will feel quite a bit like deja vu for you this year because those that didn't pass will be coming forward again. But the Board of Medical Practice will be bringing a renewal cycle conversion bill forward to move all of our 8 professions to a birth month renewal cycle. I'm aware that the Board of Dentistry is bringing forward an emeritus license bill this session. There are a couple of boards that had some fees lost in places that will be coming back again. But those bills were all familiar to you last session, and we look forward to working with you again this year.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Brecken.
Some of the bills, as we've mentioned, you may not see in this committee because they, will be policy only and they don't have a fiscal note. I do want to emphasize on behalf of all of the executive directors that we are really happy to assist you in any way that we can. If you have questions regarding specific pieces of legislation that you believe might impact the boards or maybe even don't impact the boards, if we can be of assistance, don't hesitate to call upon us, and we'll try to help you in any way we can, and we'll find out an answer to your question, Representative Hamilton.
Yeah, well, thank you both very much for your presentation. I do have one question, and that is that if you were going to change the name of the boards and not call them health-related licensing boards, what would you call them?
Madam Chair, we've had some discussion about that, but I'm not sure that we're prepared to offer that on behalf of all of the boards right now.
Okay. All right. Well,
Madam Chair.
Representative Bierman.
Yeah, just a question on the mental health, specifically chemical dependency treatment centers. Do you have oversight over them at all?
Ms. Brecken.
Madam Chair, Representative Bierman, no, we do not have. The boards have authority over individuals who are licensed to practice a particular profession, and in some very small instances, such as the Board of Pharmacy having over pharmacies and wholesale companies, that sort of thing. But most of the boards have authority only over the individuals they license, not facilities or businesses.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Other questions, members? I'm not seeing any. Well, we appreciate it very much, and members, I do think that what our testifier said about the boards being available, if you have questions about how the various professions function or how some piece of policy that you're thinking about might be administered and so on, as they said, they are a great resource. And so the next meeting, we are going to hear from Commissioner Malcolm from the Department of Health and get her budget overview. And Mr. Berg and Anna Mingy from MMB are going to give us some more about the Healthcare Access Fund, since that's going to be kind of a big topic this year. So with that, we are adjourned.